logistics of entirely secular conflicts. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition, as the World War II song said. A crusade or a jihad can be investigated by researchers in many disciplines, from anthropology and military history to nutrition and metallurgy. In his book Rocks of Ages, 1999, the late Stephen Jay Gould defended the political hypothesis that science and religion are two non-overlapping magisteria, two domains of concern and inquiry that can coexist peacefully as long as neither poaches on the other's special province. The magisterium of science is factual truth on all matters, and the magisterium of religion, he claimed, is the realm of morality and the meaning of life. Although Gould's desire for peace between these often warring perspectives was laudable, his proposal found little favor on either side, since in the minds of the religious it proposed abandoning all religious claims to factual truth and understanding of the natural world, including the claims that God created the universe or performs miracles or listens to prayers, whereas in the minds of the secularists it granted too much authority to religion in matters of ethics and meaning. Gould exposed some clear instances of immodest folly on both sides. But the claim that all conflict between the two perspectives is due to overreaching by one side or the other is implausible, and few readers were persuaded. But whether or not the case can be made for Gould's proposal, my proposal is different. There may be some domain that is religion's alone to command, some realm of human activity that science can't properly address and religion can. But that does not mean that science cannot or should not study this very fact. Gould's own book was presumably a product of just such a scientific investigation, albeit a rather informal one. He looked at religion with the eyes of a scientist and thought he could see a boundary that revealed two domains of human activity. Was he right? That is presumably a scientific, factual question, not a religious question. I am not suggesting that science should try to do what religion does, but that it should study scientifically what religion does. One of the surprising discoveries of modern psychology is how easy it is to be ignorant of your own ignorance. You are normally oblivious of your own blind spot, and people are typically amazed to discover that we don't see colors in our peripheral vision. It seems as if we do, but we don't, as you can prove to yourself by wiggling colored cards at the edge of your vision. You'll see motion just fine, but not be able to identify the color of the moving thing. It takes special provoking like that to get the absence of information to reveal itself to us. And the absence of information about religion is what I want to draw to everyone's attention. We have neglected to gather a wealth of information about something of great import to us. This may come as a surprise. Haven't we been looking carefully at religion for a long time? Yes, of course. There have been centuries of insightful and respectful scholarship about the history and variety of religious phenomena. This work, like the bounty gathered by dedicated bird watchers and other nature lovers before Darwin's time, is proving to be a hugely valuable resource to those pioneers who are now beginning, for the first time really, to study the natural phenomena of religion through the eyes of contemporary science. Darwin's breakthrough in biology was enabled by his deep knowledge of the wealth of empirical details scrupulously garnered by hundreds of pre-Darwinian, non-Darwinian natural historians. Their theoretical innocence was itself an important check on his enthusiasm. They had not gathered their facts with an eye to proving Darwinian theory correct, and we can be equally grateful that almost all the natural history of religion that has been accumulated to date is, if not theoretically innocent, at least oblivious to the sorts of theories that now may be supported or undercut by it. The research to date has hardly been neutral, however. We don't just walk up to religious phenomena and study them point blank as if they were fossils or soybeans in a field. Researchers tend to be either respectful, deferential, diplomatic, tentative, or hostile, invasive, and contemptuous. It is just about impossible to be neutral in your approach to religion. because many people view neutrality in itself as hostile. If you're not for us, you're against us. And so, since religion so clearly matters so much to so many people, researchers have almost never even attempted to be neutral. They have tended to err on the side of deference, putting on the kid gloves. It is either that or open hostility. For this reason, there has been an unfortunate pattern in the work that has been done. People who want to study religion usually have an axe to grind. They either want to defend their favorite religion from its critics, or want to demonstrate the irrationality and futility of religion, and this tends to infect their methods with bias. Such distortion is not inevitable. Scientists in every field have pet theories they hope to confirm or target hypotheses they yearn to demolish, but knowing this, they take a variety of tried-and-true steps to prevent their bias from polluting their evidence gathering. Double-blind experiments, peer review, statistical tests, and many other standard constraints of good scientific method. But in the study of religion, the stakes have often been seen to be higher. If you think that the disconfirmation of a hypothesis about one religious phenomenon or another would not be just an undesirable crack in the foundation of some theory, but a moral calamity, you tend not to run all the controls, or so at least it has often seemed to observers. That impression, true or false, has created a positive feedback loop. Scientists don't want to deal with second-rate colleagues, so they tend to shun topics where they see what they take to be mediocre work being done. This self-selection is a frustrating pattern that begins when students think about choosing a major in college. The best students typically shop around, and if they are unimpressed by the work they are introduced to in the first course in a field, they cross that field off their list for good. When I was an undergraduate, physics was still the glamour field. And then the race to the moon drew more than its share of talent. A fossil trace is the phrase, "Hey, it's not rocket science." This was followed by computer science for a while, and all along, for half a century and more, biology, especially molecular biology, has attracted many of the smartest. Today, cognitive science and the various strands of evolutionary biology, bioinformatics, genetics, developmental biology, are on the rise. But through all this period, sociology and anthropology, social psychology, and my own home field, philosophy, have struggled along, attracting those whose interests match the field well, including some brilliant people, but having to combat somewhat unenviable reputations. As my old friend and former colleague Nelson Pike, a respected philosopher of religion, once ruefully put it, "If you are in a company of people of mixed occupations, and somebody asks what you do, and you say you are a college professor, a glazed look comes into his eye. If you are in a company of professors from various departments, and somebody asks what is your field, and you say philosophy, a glazed look comes into his eye. If you are at a conference of philosophers, and somebody asks you what you are working on, and you say philosophy of religion," quoted in Bambro, 1980. This is not just a problem for philosophers of religion. It is equally a problem for sociologists of religion, psychologists of religion, and other social scientists, economists, political scientists, and for those few brave neuroscientists and other biologists who have decided to look at religious phenomena with the tools of their trade. One of the factors is that people think they already know everything they need to know about religion. And this received wisdom is pretty bland, not provocative enough to inspire either refutation or extension. In fact, if you set out to design an impermeable barrier between scientists and an underexplored phenomenon, you could hardly do better than to fabricate the dreary aura of low prestige, backbiting, and dubious results that currently envelops the topic of religion. And since we know from the outset that many people think such research violates a taboo, or at least meddles impertinently in matters best left private, It is not so surprising that few good researchers in any discipline want to touch the topic. I myself certainly felt that way until recently. These obstacles can be overcome. In the 20th century, a lot was learned about how to study human phenomena, social phenomena. Wave after wave of research and criticism has sharpened our appreciation of the particular pitfalls, such as biases in data gathering, investigator interference effects, and the interpretation of data. Statistical and analytical techniques have become much more sophisticated, and we have begun setting aside the old oversimplified models of human perception, emotion, motivation, and control of action, and replacing them with more physiologically and psychologically realistic models. The yawning chasm that was seen to separate the sciences of the mind, Geisteswissenschaften, from the natural sciences, Naturwissenschaften, has not yet been bridged securely, but many lines have been flung across the divide. Mutual suspicion and professional jealousy, as well as genuine theoretical controversy, continue to shake almost all efforts to carry insights back and forth on these connecting routes. But every day the traffic grows. The question is not whether good science of religion as a natural phenomenon is possible. It is. The question is whether we should do it. 2. Should science study religion? Look before you leap. Aesop, The Fox and the Goat. Research is expensive and sometimes has harmful side effects. One of the lessons of the 20th century is that scientists are not above confabulating justifications for the work they want to do, driven by insatiable curiosity. Are there in fact good reasons, aside from sheer curiosity, to try to develop the natural science of religion? Do we need this for anything? Would it help us choose policies, respond to problems, improve our world? What do we know about the future of religion? Consider 5 wildly different hypotheses. 1. The Enlightenment is long gone, the creeping secularization of modern societies that has been anticipated for 2 centuries is evaporating before our eyes. The tide is turning, and religion is becoming more important than ever. In this scenario, religion soon resumes something like the dominant social and moral role it had before the rise of modern science in the 17th century. As people recover from their infatuation with technology and material comforts, spiritual identity becomes a person's most valued attribute. And populations come to be ever more sharply divided among Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, and a few other major multinational religious organizations. Eventually, it might take another millennium, or it might be hastened by catastrophe. 1 major faith sweeps the planet. 2. Religion is in its death throes. Today's outbursts of fervor and fanaticism are but a brief and awkward transition to a truly modern society in which religion plays at most a ceremonial role. In this scenario, although there may be some local and temporary revivals and even some violent catastrophes, the major religions of the world soon go just as extinct as the hundreds of minor religions that are vanishing faster than anthropologists can record them. Within the lifetimes of our grandchildren, Vatican City becomes the European Museum of Roman Catholicism, and Mecca is turned into Disney's Magic Kingdom of Allah. 3. Religions transform themselves into institutions unlike anything seen before on the planet. Basically, creedless associations selling self-help and enabling moral teamwork, using ceremony and tradition to cement relationships and build long-term fan loyalty. In this scenario, being a member of a religion becomes more and more like being a Boston Red Sox fan or a Dallas Cowboys fan. Different colors, different songs and cheers, different symbols and vigorous competition. Would you want your daughter to marry a Yankees fan? But aside from a rabid few, everybody appreciates the importance of peaceful coexistence in a global league of religions. Religious art and music flourish, and friendly rivalry leads to a degree of specialization, with one religion priding itself on its environmental stewardship, providing clean water for the world's billions, while another becomes duly famous for its concerted defense of social justice and economic equality. 4. Religion diminishes in prestige and visibility rather like smoking. It is tolerated, since there are those who say they can't live without it, but it is discouraged, and teaching religion to impressionable young children is frowned upon in most societies and actually outlawed in others. In this scenario, politicians who still practice religion can be elected if they prove themselves worthy in other regards, but few would advertise their religious affiliation, or affliction, as the politically incorrect insist on calling it. It is considered as rude to draw attention to the religion of somebody as it is to comment in public about his sexuality or whether she has been divorced. 5. Judgment Day arrives. The blessed ascend bodily into heaven, and the rest are left behind to suffer the agonies of the damned, as the Antichrist is vanquished. As the Bible prophecies foretold, the rebirth of the nation of Israel in 1948 and the ongoing conflict over Palestine are clear signs of the end times, when the second coming of Christ sweeps all the other hypotheses into oblivion. Other possibilities are describable, of course, but these five hypotheses highlight the extremes that are taken seriously. What is remarkable about the set is that just about anybody would find at least one of them preposterous, or troubling, or even deeply offensive. But every one of them is not just anticipated, but yearned for. People act on what they yearn for. We are at cross purposes about religion, to say the least, so we can anticipate problems, ranging from wasted effort and counterproductive campaigns if we are lucky to all-out war and genocidal catastrophe if we are not. Only one of these hypotheses, at most, will turn out to be true. The rest are not just wrong, but wildly wrong. Many people think they know which is true, but nobody does. Isn't that fact, all by itself, enough reason to study religion scientifically? Whether you want religion to flourish or perish, whether you think it should transform itself or stay just as it is, you can hardly deny that whatever happens will be of tremendous significance to the planet. It would be useful to your hopes, whatever they are, to know more about what is likely to happen and why. In this regard, it is worth noting how assiduously those who firmly believe in number 5 scan the world news for evidence of prophecies fulfilled. They sort and evaluate their sources, debating the pros and cons of various interpretations of those prophecies. They think there is a reason to investigate the future of religion, and they don't even think the course of future events lies within human power to determine. The rest of us have all the more reason to investigate the phenomena, since it is quite obvious that complacency and ignorance could lead us to squander our opportunities to steer the phenomena in what we take to be the benign directions. Looking ahead, anticipating the future, is the crowning achievement of our species. We have managed, in a few short millennia of human culture, to multiply the planet's supply of look-ahead by many orders of magnitude. We know when eclipses will occur centuries in advance. We can predict the effects on the atmosphere of adjustments in how we generate electricity. We can anticipate in broad outline what will happen as our petroleum reserves dwindle in the next decades. We do this not with miraculous prophecy, but with basic perception. We gather information from the environment using our senses, and then we use science to cobble together anticipations based on that information. We mine the ore and then refine it again and again, and it lets us see into the future, dimly, with lots of uncertainty, but much better than a coin toss. In every area of human concern, we have learned how to anticipate and then avoid catastrophes that used to blindside us. We have recently forestalled a global disaster due to a growing hole in the ozone layer because some far-seeing chemists were able to prove that some of our manufactured compounds were causing the problem. We have avoided economic collapses in recent years because our economic models have shown us impending problems. A catastrophe averted is an anticlimax, obviously, so we tend not to appreciate how valuable our powers of look-ahead are. See, we complain, it wasn't going to happen after all. The flu season in the winter of 2003-2004 was predicted to be severe, since it arrived earlier than usual. But the broadcast recommendations for inoculation were so widely heeded that the epidemic collapsed as rapidly as it began. Ho-hum. It has become something of a tradition in recent years for the meteorologists on television to hype an oncoming hurricane or other storm, and then for the public to be underwhelmed by the actual storm. But sober evaluations show that many lives are saved, destruction is minimized. We accept the value of intensely studying El Niño and the other cycles in ocean currents so that we can do better meteorological forecasting. We keep exhaustive records of many economic events so that we can do better economic forecasting. We should extend the same intense scrutiny for the same reasons to religious phenomena. Few forces in the world are as potent, as influential as religion. As we struggle to resolve the terrible economic and social inequities that currently disfigure our planet, and minimize the violence and degradation we see, we have to recognize that if we have a blind spot about religion, our efforts will almost certainly fail and may make matters much worse. We wouldn't permit the world's food-producing interests to deflect us from studying human agriculture and nutrition. And we have learned not to exempt the banking and insurance world from intense and continuous scrutiny. Their effects are too important to take on faith. So what I am calling for is a concerted effort to achieve a mutual agreement under which religion, all religion, becomes a proper object of scientific study. Here I find that opinion is divided among those who are already convinced that this would be a good idea, those who are dubious and inclined to doubt that it would be of much value, and those who find the proposal evil, offensive, dangerous, and stupid. Not wanting to preach to the converted, I am particularly concerned to address those who hate this idea, in hopes of persuading them that their repugnance is misplaced. This is a daunting task, like trying to persuade your friend with the cancer symptoms that she really ought to see a doctor now, since her anxiety may be misplaced, and the sooner she learns that, the sooner she can get on with her life. And if she does have cancer, timely intervention may make all the difference. Friends can get quite annoyed when you interfere with their denial at times like that, but perseverance is called for. Yes, I want to put religion on the examination table. If it is fundamentally benign, as many of its devotees insist, it should emerge just fine. Suspicions will be put to rest, and we can then concentrate on the few peripheral pathologies that religion, like every other natural phenomenon, falls prey to. If it is not, the sooner we identify the problems clearly, the better. Will the inquiry itself generate some discomfort and embarrassment? Almost certainly. But that is a small price to pay. Is there a risk that such an invasive examination will make a healthy religion ill, or even disable it? Of course, there are always risks. Are they worth taking? Perhaps not. But I haven't yet seen an argument that persuades me of this, and we will soon consider the best of them. The only arguments worth attending to will have to demonstrate that, one, religion provides net benefits to humankind, and, two, these benefits would be unlikely to survive such an investigation. I, for one, fear that if we don't subject religion to such scrutiny now, and work out together whatever revisions and reforms are called for, we will pass on a legacy of ever more toxic forms of religion to our descendants. I can't prove that, and those who are dead sure that this will not happen are encouraged to say what supports their conviction, aside from loyalty to their tradition, which goes without saying and doesn't count for anything here. In general, knowing more improves your chances of getting what you value. That's not quite a truth of logic, since uncertainty is not the only factor that can lower the probability of achieving one's goals. The costs of knowing, such as the cost of coming to know, must be factored in. And these costs may be high, which is why wing it is sometimes good advice. Suppose there is a limit on how much knowledge about some topic is good for us. If so, then, whenever that limit is reached, if that is possible, the limit may be unreachable for one reason or another, we should prohibit or at least strongly discourage any further seeking of knowledge on that topic as antisocial activity. This may be a principle that never comes into play, but we don't know that, and we should certainly accept the principle. It may be, then, that some of our major disagreements in the world today are about whether we've reached such a limit. This reflection puts the Islamist conviction that Western science is a bad thing in a different light. It may not be an ignorant mistake so much as a profoundly different view of where the threshold is. Sometimes ignorance is bliss. We need to consider such possibilities carefully. 3. Might music be bad for you? Music, the greatest good that mortals know, and all of heaven we have below. Joseph Addison. Is it not strange that sheep's guts should hail souls out of men's bodies? William Shakespeare. It is not that I don't sympathize with the distaste of those who resist my proposal. Trying to imagine what their emotional response to my proposal would be, I have come up with an unsettling thought experiment that seems to me to do the trick. I am speaking now to those who, like me, are not appalled by the idea of this examination. Imagine how you would feel if you were to read in the science section of the New York Times that new research conducted at Cambridge University and Caltech showed that music, long viewed as one of the unalloyed treasures of human culture, is actually bad for your health, a major risk factor for Alzheimer's and heart disease, a mood distorter that impairs judgment in subtle but clearly deleterious ways, a significant contributor to aggressive tendencies, xenophobia, and weakness of will. Early and habitual exposure to music, both performing and listening, makes you 40% more likely to suffer serious depression, knocks an average of 10 points off your IQ, and nearly doubles the probability that you will commit an act of violence at some time in your life. A panel of researchers recommends that people restrict their music intake to no more than an hour a day, including everything from elevator music and background music on television to symphony concerts, and that the widespread practice of music lessons for children be curtailed immediately. Aside from the utter disbelief with which I would greet a report of such findings, I can detect in my imagined reactions a visceral defensive surge along the lines of, "So much the worse for Cambridge and Caltech, what do they know about music?" and, "I don't care if it is true. Anybody who tries to take away my music had better be prepared for a fight, because a life without music isn't worth living. I don't care if it hurts me, and I don't even care if it hurts others. We're going to have music, and that's all there is to it." That is how I would be tempted to respond. I would rather not live in a world without music. But why, someone might ask? It's just some silly sawing away and making noise together. It doesn't feed the hungry or cure cancer or... I answer, but it brings great comfort and joy to hundreds of millions of people. Sure, there are excesses and controversies, but still, can anybody doubt that music is by and large a good thing? Well, yes, comes the reply. There are religious sects, the Taliban, for instance, but also Puritan sects of yore and Christianity, and no doubt others, that have held that music is an evil pastime, a sort of drug to be forbidden. The idea is not clearly insane, so we should accept the intellectual burden of showing that it is an error. I recognize that many people feel about religion the way I feel about music. They may be right. Let's find out. That is, let's subject religion to the same sort of scientific inquiry that we have done with tobacco and alcohol, and, for that matter, music. Let's find out why people love their religion and what it's good for. And we should no more take the existing research to settle the issue than we took the tobacco company's campaigns about the safety of cigarette smoking at face value. Sure, religion saves lives. So does tobacco. Ask those GIs for whom tobacco was an even greater comfort than religion during World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam. I'm prepared to look hard at the pros and cons of music. And if it turns out that music causes cancer, ethnic hatred, and war, then I'll have to think seriously about how to live without music. It is only because I am so supremely confident that music doesn't do much harm that I can enjoy it with such a clear conscience. If I were told by credible people that music might be harmful to the world, all things considered, I would feel morally bound to examine the evidence as dispassionately as I could. In fact, I would feel guilty about my allegiance to music if I didn't check it out. But isn't the hypothesis that the costs of religion outweigh the benefits even more ludicrous than the fantastic claim about music? I don't think so. Music may be what Marx said religion is, the opiate of the masses, keeping working people in tranquilized subjugation. But it may also be the rallying song of revolution, closing up the ranks and giving heart to all. On this point, music and religion have quite similar profiles. In other regards, music looks far less problematic than religion. Over the millennia, music has started a few riots, and charismatic musicians may have sexually abused a shocking number of susceptible young fans and seduced many others to leave their families and their wits behind. But no crusades or jihads have been waged over differences in musical tradition. No pogroms have been instituted against the lovers of waltzes or ragas or tangos. Whole populations haven't been subjected to obligatory scale playing or kept in penury in order to furnish concert halls with the finest acoustics and instruments. No musicians have had fatwas pronounced against them by musical organizations, not even accordionists. The comparison of religion to music is particularly useful here, since music is another natural phenomenon that has been ably studied by scholars for hundreds of years, but is only just beginning to be an object of the sort of scientific study I am recommending. There has been no dearth of professional research on music theory, harmony, counterpoint, rhythm, or the techniques of musicianship, or the history of every genre and instrument. Ethnomusicologists have studied the evolution of musical styles and practices in relation to social, economic, and other cultural factors, and neuroscientists and psychologists have rather recently begun studying the perception and creation of music, using all the latest technology to uncover the patterns of brain activity associated with musical experience, musical memory, and related topics. But most of this research still takes music for granted. It seldom asks, why does music exist? There is a short answer, and it is true so far as it goes. It exists because we love it, and hence we keep bringing more of it into existence. But why do we love it? Because we find that it is beautiful. But why is it beautiful to us? This is a perfectly good biological question, but it does not yet have a good answer. Compare it, for instance, with the question, why do we love sweets? Here we know the evolutionary answer in some detail, and it has some curious twists. It is no accident that we find sweet things to our liking, and if we want to adjust our policies regarding sweet things in the future, we had better understand the evolutionary basis of their appeal. We mustn't make the mistake of the man in the old joke, who complained that just when he'd finally succeeded in training his donkey not to eat, the stupid animal up and died on him. Some things are necessary to life, and some things are at least so life-enhancing or life-enabling that we tamper with them at our peril, and we need to figure out these roles and needs. Ever since the Enlightenment in the 18th century, many quite well-informed and brilliant people have confidently thought that religion would soon vanish, the object of a human taste that could be satisfied by other means. Many are still waiting, somewhat less confidently. Whatever religion provides for us, it is something that many think they cannot live without. Let's take them seriously this time, for they might be right. But there is only one way to take them seriously. We need to study them scientifically. 4. Would neglect be more benign? Sweet is the lore which nature brings. Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things. We murder to dissect. William Wordsworth, The Tables Turned. Why then must science and scientists continue to be governed by fear? Fear of public opinion, fear of social consequence, fear of religious intolerance, fear of political pressure, and above all, fear of bigotry and prejudice, as much within as without the professional world. William Masters and Virginia Johnson, Human Sexual Response. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Jesus of Nazareth, in John chapter 8, verse 32. It is time to confront the worry that such an investigation might actually kill all the specimens, destroying something precious in the name of discovering its inner nature. Wouldn't it be more prudent to leave well enough alone? As I have already noted, the case for curbing our curiosity here has two parts. It must show both, one, that religion provides net benefits to humankind, and two, that these benefits would be unlikely to survive such an investigation. The tactical problem that confronts us is that there is really no way of showing the first point without actually engaging in the investigation. Religion seems to many people to be the source of many wonderful things, but others doubt this for compelling reasons. And we shouldn't just concede the point out of a misplaced respect for tradition. Perhaps this very respect is like the protective outer shell that often conceals deadly viruses from our immune system, a sort of camouflage that disengages much-needed criticism. So the most we can say is that point one is not yet proven. We can, however, proceed tentatively and consider how likely point two would be if we were to assume, for the sake of argument, that religion is indeed a thing of great value. We can assume it innocent until proven guilty. In other words, just the way our legal system operates. Now, what about point two? How much damage do we suppose an investigation might do in the worst case? Might it not break the spell and disenchant us forever? This concern has been a favorite ground for resisting scientific curiosity for centuries. But although it is undeniable that taking apart particular instances of wonderful things, plants, animals, musical instruments, may sometimes destroy them beyond recognition, other wonderful things, poems, symphonies, theories, legal systems, thrive on analysis, however painstaking. And one can hardly deny the benefit to other plants, animals, and musical instruments derived from dissecting a few specimens. In spite of all the warnings over the centuries, I have been unable to come up with a case of some valuable phenomenon that has actually been destroyed or even seriously damaged by scientific scrutiny. Field biologists often confront a terrible quandary when studying an endangered species. Does their well-meant attempt at a census involving live capture and release actually hasten the extinction of the species? When anthropologists descend on a heretofore isolated and pristine people, their inquiries, however discreet and diplomatic, swiftly change the culture they are so eager to know. With regard to the former cases, thou shalt not study is a policy that may indeed be wisely invoked on occasion. But with regard to the latter, prolonging the isolation of people by putting them in effect in a cultural zoo, though it is sometimes advocated, does not bear scrutiny. These are people, and we have no right to keep them ignorant of the larger world they share with us. Whether they have the right to keep themselves ignorant is one of the vexing questions to be considered later in this book. It is worth recalling that it took brave pioneers many years to overcome the powerful taboo against the dissection of human cadavers during the early years of modern medicine. And we should note that, notwithstanding the outrage and revulsion with which the idea of dissection was then received, overcoming that tradition has not led to the feared collapse of morality and decency. We live in an era in which human corpses are still treated with due respect. Indeed, with rather more respect and decorum than they were treated with at the time dissection was still disreputable. And which of us would choose to forego the benefits of medicine made possible by the invasive, meddling science Wordsworth deplores? More recently, another taboo was broken with even greater outcry. Alfred C. Kinsey, in the 1940s and 1950s, began the scientific investigation of human sexual practices in America that led to the notorious Kinsey reports, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, 1948, and Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, 1953. There were substantial flaws in Kinsey's studies, but the weight of the evidence he amassed led to surprising conclusions that have needed only minor adjustments in the wake of the better-controlled investigations that followed. For the first time, boys and men could learn that over 90% of American males masturbate, and that around 10% are homosexual. Girls and women could learn that orgasms were normal and achievable for them as well, both in coitus and in masturbation, and, not surprisingly in retrospect, that lesbians were better at inducing orgasms in women than men were. Kinsey's research tools were interviews and questionnaires. But soon William H. Masters and Virginia Johnson got up the nerve to subject human sexual arousal to scientific investigation in the laboratory, recording the physiological responses of volunteers engaged in sexual acts, using all the tools of science, including color cinematography. This was before the ready availability of videotape. Their pioneering work, Human Sexual Response, 1966, was met with a wild mixture of hostility and outrage, amusement and prurient fascination, and cautious applause from the medical and scientific community. By shining the bright light of science on what had heretofore been conducted in the dark, with a huge measure of secrecy and shame, they dispelled a host of myths, revised the medical understanding of some kinds of sexual dysfunction, liberated untold numbers of anxious people whose tastes and practices had been under a cloud of socially inculcated disapproval, and, wonder of wonders, improved the sex lives of millions. It turns out that in this case, at least, you can break the spell and yet not break the spell at the same time. You can violate the taboo against dispassionate study of a phenomenon, there's one spell broken, and not destroy it in the process. There's a spell one can still blissfully fall under. But at what cost? I deliberately draw attention to Masters and Johnson's still controversial work, since it illustrates so clearly the difficult issues with which this book will be concerned. Many will agree with me when I say that, thanks to the pioneering work of Kinsey and Masters and Johnson, the knowledge we have acquired has not only not destroyed sex, it has made sex better. But there are also many who will pounce on the comparison and declare that this is exactly why they oppose any scientific exploration of religion. There is a chance it might do for religion what Kinsey et al. Did for sex, teach us more than is good for us. Let me put words in their mouths. If masturbating without shame, tolerance for homosexuality, and greater knowledge of how to achieve female orgasm are examples of the benefits science can bring us, then so much the worse for science. By treating sex as something natural, in the sense of nothing to be ashamed about, it has contributed to an explosion of pornography and degradation, defiling the sacred act of procreative union between husband and wife. We were better off not knowing all these facts, and we should take whatever steps we can to shelter our children from this contaminating information. This is a very serious objection. There is no denying that the matter-of-fact candor about sex that was fostered by this research has had some terrible side effects, opening up new and fertile fields for exploitation by those who are always looking for ways to prey upon their fellow citizens. The sexual revolution of the 60s was not the glorious and all-benign liberation that it is often portrayed as being. The explorations of free love and open marriage broke many hearts and robbed many young people of a deep sense of the moral importance of sexual relations by encouraging a shallow vision of sex as mere entertainment of the senses. Although it is widely believed that the sexual revolution contributed to the negligence and casual promiscuity that have heightened the scourge of sexually transmitted diseases, this may not be the case. Most evidence suggests that when information about sex is widespread, sexual behavior becomes more responsible. Posner, 1992. But anyone raising a child today has to worry about the surfeit of information about sex that now engulfs us. Knowledge really is power, for good and for ill, knowledge can have the power to disrupt ancient patterns of belief and action, the power to subvert authority, the power to change minds. It can interfere with trends that may or may not be desirable. In a notorious memorandum to President Richard Nixon, Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote, "The time may have come when the issue of race could benefit from a period of benign neglect. The subject has been too much talked about. The forum has been too much taken over by hysterics, paranoids, and boodlers on all sides. We may need a period in which Negro progress continues and racial rhetoric fades. The administration can help bring this about by paying close attention to such progress, as we are doing, while seeking to avoid situations in which extremists of either race are given opportunities for martyrdom, heroics, histrionics, or whatever." Moynihan, 1970. We will probably never know if Moynihan was right, but he may have been. Those who suspect that he was right may hope that we follow his advice this time, postponing vigorous attention to religion as long as possible, deflecting inquiry, and hoping for the best. But it is hard to see how this policy could be achieved in any case. Since the Enlightenment, we have already had more than 200 years of deferential, muted curiosity, and it doesn't seem to have led to the fading of religious rhetoric, does it? Recent history strongly suggests that religion is going to garner more and more attention, not less, in the immediate future. If it is going to receive attention, it had better be high-quality attention, not the sort that hysterics, paranoids, and boodlers on all sides engage in. The problem is that it is just too hard nowadays to keep secrets. Whereas in earlier centuries, ignorance was the default condition of most of the human race, and it took a considerable exercise of inquiry to learn about the wide world, today we are all swimming in a sea of information and misinformation on every topic, from masturbation to how to build a nuclear weapon to Al-Qaeda. As we deplore the attempt by some religious leaders in the Muslim world to keep their girls and women uneducated and uninformed about the world, we can hardly approve of similar embargoes on knowledge in our own sphere. Or can we? Perhaps this point of disagreement is the continental divide in opinion space. Between those who think our best hope is to try to nail the lid on Pandora's box and keep ourselves forever ignorant, and those who think that this is politically impossible and immoral in the first place. The former already pay a heavy price for their self-imposed factual poverty. They can't imagine in detail the consequences of their own chosen policy. Can they not see that nothing short of a police state, bristling with laws prohibiting inquiry and the dissemination of knowledge or the sequestration of the population in a windowless world, could accomplish the feat? Is that really what they want? Do they think that they have methods undreamt of by the conservative mullahs for halting the inexorable flow of liberating information to their flock? Think ahead. There is a trap here lying in wait of those without foresight. Perhaps no parents are immune to a twinge of regret when they see the first evidence of loss of innocence in their child, and the urge to shelter a child from the tawdry world is strong. But reflection should show anybody that it just won't work. We need to let our children grow up to face the world armed with knowledge, with much more knowledge than we ourselves had at their age. It is scary, but the alternative is worse. There are some people, millions apparently, who proudly declare that they do not have to foresee the consequences. They know in their hearts that this is the right path, whatever the details. Since Judgment Day is just around the corner, there is no reason to plan for the future. If you are one of these, here is what I hope will be a sobering reflection. Have you considered that you are perhaps being irresponsible? You would willingly risk not only the lives and future well-being of your loved ones, but also the lives and future well-being of all the rest of us, without hesitation, without due diligence, guided by one revelation or another, a conviction that you have no good way of checking for soundness. Every prudent man dealeth with knowledge, but a fool layeth open his folly. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 16. Yes, I know, the Bible has a contrary text as well. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 19. Anybody can quote the Bible to prove anything, which is why you ought to worry about being overconfident. Do you ever ask yourself, what if I'm wrong? Of course, there is a large crowd of others around you who share your conviction, and this distributes, and alas, dilutes, the responsibility. So, if you ever get a chance to breathe a word of regret, you will have a handy excuse. You got swept up by a crowd of enthusiasts. But surely you have noticed a troubling fact. History gives us many examples of large crowds of deluded people egging one another on down the primrose path to perdition. How can you be so sure you're not part of such a group? I, for one, am not in awe of your faith. I am appalled by your ignorance, by your unreasonable certainty that you have all the answers. I wonder if any believers in the end times will have the intellectual honesty and courage to read this book through. What we dimly imagine in dreaded anticipation often turns out to be much worse than reality. Before we lament our inability to hold back the rising tide of information, we should consider its likely consequences calmly. They may not be so bad. Imagine, if you can, that we had never had the Santa Claus myth at all. That Christmas was just another Christian feast, like Palm Sunday or Pentecost. Celebrated, but barely anticipated in the wide world. And imagine that the fans of J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter stories were to attempt to start a new tradition. Every year, on the anniversary of the publication date of the first Harry Potter book, children shall receive gifts from Harry Potter, who flies in through the window on his magic broomstick, accompanied by his owl. Let's make Harry Potter Day a worldwide day for children. Toy manufacturers and Rowling's publishers would all be in favor, presumably, but imagine the doomsayers who would oppose it. What a terrible idea. Think of the traumatic effects on young children when they learn, as they eventually would, that their innocence and trust had been exploited by a gigantic public conspiracy of grown-ups. The psychic and social toll of such a massive deception would be cynicism, despair, paranoia, and grief that might cripple children for life. Could there be anything more evil than deliberately concocting a seductive set of lies to spread to our children? They will hate us bitterly, and we will deserve their fury. Had this quite compelling concern been effectively raised in the early days of the evolving Santa Claus mythology, it might well have prevented the great Santa Claus catastrophe of 1985. But we know better. There was no such catastrophe and never will be. Some children do suffer relatively brief bouts of embarrassment and bitterness on learning that there is no Santa Claus, but others take delicious pride in their Sherlock Holmes triumph of detection and relish their new status among those in the know, eagerly contributing to the ruse next year, and soberly answering all the innocent questions put to them by their younger siblings. So far as we know, the Santa Claus disillusionment does no harm. More to the point, it is likely, but not yet investigated to the best of my knowledge, that part of the enduring appeal of the Santa Claus myth is that adults, who can no longer directly experience the innocent joys of Santa anticipation, settle for the vicarious thrill of enjoying their children's excitement. People do go to a great deal of effort and expense to perpetuate the Santa Claus mythology. Why? Are they trying to recapture the lost innocence of childhood? Are they more directly motivated by their own gratification than by generosity? Or are the pleasures of conspiracy with community absolution, untarnished by the guilt that accompanies the conspiracies of adultery, embezzlement, or tax evasion, for example, enough on their own to pay for the substantial costs? Such impertinent ways of thinking will loom large in subsequent chapters when we turn to the more upsetting questions about why religion is so popular. They are not rhetorical questions. They can be answered if we try. I appreciate that many readers will be profoundly distrustful of the tack I am taking here. They will see me as just another liberal professor trying to cajole them out of some of their convictions, and they are dead right about that. That's what I am, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do. Why, then, should they pay any attention? They are appalled by the moral decay they see on all sides and are sincerely convinced that the protection of their religion from all inquiry and criticism is the best way to turn the tide. I wholeheartedly agree with them that there is a moral crisis and that nothing is more important than working together on finding paths out of our current dilemmas. But I think I have a better way. Prove it, they will say. Let me try, I respond. That's what this book is about. And I ask them to try to read it with an open mind. Chapter 2. Religion is not out of bounds to science in spite of propaganda to the contrary from a variety of sources. Moreover, scientific inquiry is needed to inform our most momentous political decisions. There is risk and even pain involved, but it would be irresponsible to use that as an excuse for ignorance. Chapter 3. If we want to know why we value the things we love, we need to delve into the evolutionary history of the planet, uncovering the forces and constraints that have generated the glorious array of things we treasure. Religion is not exempt from this survey, and we can sketch out a variety of promising avenues for further research. While coming to understanding how we can achieve a perspective on our own inquiries that all can share, regardless of their different creeds. Chapter 3. Why Good Things Happen. 1. Bringing Out the Best. Religious allegory has become a part of the fabric of reality. And living in that reality helps millions of people cope and be better people. Langdon, Hero of the Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown. When I began working on this book, I conducted interviews with quite a few people to try to get a sense of the different roles that religion plays in their lives. This was not scientific data gathering, though I have also done some of that, but rather an attempt to set theories and experiments aside and go directly to real people and let them tell me in their own words why religion was so important to them. These were strictly confidential interviews, almost all one-on-one, and although I was persistently inquisitive, I didn't challenge or argue with my informants. These occasions were often moving, to say the least, and I learned a lot. Some people had endured hardships that I could not readily imagine myself surviving, and some had found in their religion the strength to make, and hold fast to, decisions that were nothing short of heroic. Less dramatic, but even more impressive in retrospect, were the people of modest talent and accomplishment who were, in one way or another, simply much better people than one might expect them to be. It wasn't just that their lives had meaning to them, though this was certainly true, but that they were actually making the world better by their efforts, inspired by their conviction that their lives were not their own to dispose of as they chose. Religion can certainly bring out the best in a person, but it is not the only phenomenon with that property. Having a child often has a wonderfully maturing effect on a person. Wartime, famously, gives people an abundance of occasions to rise to, as do natural disasters like floods and hurricanes. But for day in, day out, lifelong bracing, there is probably nothing so effective as religion. It makes powerful and talented people more humble and patient. It makes average people rise above themselves. It provides sturdy support for many people who desperately need help staying away from drink or drugs or crime. People who would otherwise be self-absorbed or shallow or crude or simply quitters are often ennobled by their religion, given a perspective on life that helps them make the hard decisions that we all would be proud to make. No all-in value judgment can be based on such a limited and informal survey, of course. Religion does all this good and more, no doubt, but something else we could devise might do it as well or better. There are many wise, engaged, morally committed atheists and agnostics, after all. Perhaps a survey would show that as a group, atheists and agnostics are more respectful of the law, more sensitive to the needs of others, or more ethical than religious people. Certainly no reliable survey has yet been done that shows otherwise. It might be that the best that can be said for religion is that it helps some people achieve the level of citizenship and morality typically found in brights. If you find that conjecture offensive, you need to adjust your perspective. Among the questions that we need to consider objectively, are whether Islam is more or less effective than Christianity at keeping people off drugs and alcohol, and whether the side effects in either case are worse than the benefit, whether sexual abuse is more or less of a problem among Sikhs than among Mormons, and so forth. You don't get to advertise all the good that your religion does without first scrupulously subtracting all the harm it does, and considering seriously the question of whether some other religion, or no religion at all, does better. World War II certainly brought out the best in many people, and those who lived through it often say that it was the most important thing in their lives, without which their lives would have no meaning, but it certainly doesn't follow from this that we should try to have another world war. The price you must pay for any claim about the virtue of your religion or any other religion is the willingness to see your claim put squarely to the test. My point here at the outset is just to acknowledge that we already know enough about religion to know that, however terrible its negative effects are, bigotry, murderous fanaticism, oppression, cruelty, and enforced ignorance, to cite the obvious, the people who view religion as the most important thing in life have many good reasons for thinking so. 2. Cui bono? Blessed be the Lord, who daily loadeth us with benefits, even the God of our salvation, Selah. Psalm, chapter 68, verse 19. The more we learn about the details of natural processes, the more evident it becomes that these processes are themselves creative. Nothing transcends nature like nature itself. Loyal Rue. Good things don't just happen by chance. There are strokes of luck, but sustaining a good thing isn't just luck. It might be providence, of course,